Today sees the return of the RHI inquiry after its summer break. Some very high-profile witnesses will give this evidence in the coming weeks, including the former DUP minister, Jonathan Bell, his special advisor at the time, Timothy Kearns, and the former Deputy Permanent Secretary, Dr. Andrew McCormick. Dr. McCormick's witness statement was published online last night on the RHI inquiry site. You can go there and you can read it in full. Among other things, it reveals Jonathan Bell's special advisor, Timothy Kearns, raised allegations of bullying against Mr. Bell, including a claim that he had tried to break his finger and swung a punch at him. Andrew McCormick will give evidence to the RHI inquiry later today. The newsletter's political editor, Sam McBride, with us this morning. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, Stephen.
Well, the public, through this inquiry, are getting an insight into behind the scenes of government that could be in a drama on BBC One. Were people thinking, would that really happen in reality?
That's right. Some of the evidence which comes out in this statement last night, it's more than 1,000 pages, and there's probably lots more in there which we haven't got to yet. But, I mean, it's like something out of the thick of it or Yes Minister. It's really far-fetched stuff. If you were an opponent of the DUP and you were trying to write some of this stuff, I mean, it would be difficult to make it credible, to be honest. But the fact that I think the DUP and Sinn Féin are intensely disciplined parties, their opponents would say very secretive parties, means that even some of the fairly mundane issues which are tumbling out at this inquiry are quite interesting, and because we just don't know in some cases how they do business, or if we have reason to believe there is a certain way that they do business. It's never been publicly confirmed. So what we have here is a situation where it's clear that there is really internal strife within the DUP at the very top, between Arlene Foster, who in early 2016 is the First Minister, between Jonathan Bell, who is one of her ministers. And really, they are feuding over a series of issues. They are in dispute over foreign travel, over who gets to meet Boris Johnson when he comes to Northern Ireland. There is a suggestion that Peter Robinson, who has just retired, is in some way advising Jonathan Bell in the background and all of this. I mean, it's really an extraordinary situation. And then, of course, as you said at the top of the programme, we've got this allegation from Jonathan Bell's former advisor that he was being bullied by the minister. And, of course, later this week, we'll be able to hear Mr. Bell's response to that. Now, we haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, I'm sure, Sam, that Peter Robinson may want to have a right to reply as to whether he was advising Jonathan Bell. It's my understanding that Peter Robinson's position would be that he was having a conversation with Jonathan Bell, and I'm not too sure Peter Robinson would describe that as advising.
Well, that's maybe shedding more light on this. Andrew McCormick says in his statement that his understanding was that there was a suggestion. I just don't have the exact wording in front of me. But this was much earlier than the period where Jonathan Bell did his interview with you. This was really at the start of that year, so around sort of February 2016. So Peter Robinson hadn't gone very long. In some ways, it certainly wouldn't be surprising at that point, at the very least, that Peter Robinson was in pretty regular contact with Jonathan Bell. They were known to be close within the party. Jonathan Bell employed in his constituency office, I think, at least one of Peter Robinson's family. So there were various links there and reasons why they would be discussing politics. So again, we haven't seen Peter Robinson's witness statement. It's not clear whether he will be called to give oral evidence. But as with all of this inquiry, it sort of tumbles out bit by bit, and we get allegation and sometimes counter-allegation once we get other bits of the jigsaw.
Yeah, I think that certainly a source has told me that what Peter Robinson felt that he was doing was Jonathan Bell was asking advice as to whether he should give an interview to the Nolan Show at the time. And that's what Mr. Bell was doing at the time when he was speaking to Peter Robinson. And I think Peter Robinson's position would very much be that he was taking an impartial position on that and was listening. But that's for others to decide, and obviously for the inquiry to determine. So let's let Peter Robinson give whatever evidence he wants to give to the inquiry if he's asked about that, Sam. When the public then hear about a claim that Mr. Bell tried to break someone's finger and swung a punch. That's the line from today, where surely the ordinary man and woman in the street that's gone back and forward to their job is wondering, what on earth type of government did we have?
It's really quite astonishing. I mean, in all of the 10 years of Stormont, I can't think that I ever heard of a minister being accused of physical violence in this way. This is something which has not come from Andrew McCormick, we should say. This is something which Timothy Kearns has alleged. We haven't seen the full context of this because we haven't yet seen Mr. Kearns's written statement, but it is referred to in a question which the inquiry put to Dr. McCormick. And then Dr. McCormick said that in his experience, he had a pretty good relationship with Jonathan Bell, despite a series of deep frustrations about how he operated. He said on a personal level, he got on quite well with him, and he never saw any evidence of bullying. He also said that it would be incongruous to expect that such a delicate internal party matter would come to the attention of the permanent civil service, and that is, if it had happened. So that's quite important for context. But the very nature of a special advisor, a former special advisor, alleging that his former minister had tried to physically attack him and bullied him. I mean, it's really difficult to understand how that relationship lasted for as long as it did. And part of the issue there, which the inquiry is trying to get to, and which Dr. McCormick has been asked questions about, is how it came to be that the DUP decided that Timothy Kearns should be the advisor to Jonathan Bell. It seems that very early on in that relationship, they were not getting on well. There were difficulties with this blazing row in an Indian restaurant in London just over a month, I think, after he'd been appointed. And it seems to be that while in law and at Stormont, the understanding of the civil service was that it was the minister who appointed his special advisor. It's a crucial role. It has to be somebody you trust. It has to be somebody that you can work with. It seems that it was the DUP centrally who basically assigned Timothy Kearns to Jonathan Bell, and that seems to be something from which lots of the difficulties between them has stemmed.
And Andrew McCormick, who is appearing in front of the RHI inquiry later today, he is, just for context to the general public, so he is one of the most senior civil servants in Northern Ireland. He is around a long time. His credibility was, and his integrity, Sam, and I've spoken about this, I think, once before, but I think this is important for context. The DUP put a lot of stock into Andrew McCormick's credibility and integrity, certainly when the DUP were dealing with me. For example, when I was brought up to Stormont on the night that I was interviewing the now quite high profile interview with Arlene Foster after Jonathan Bell had been interviewed. Okay, the DUP brought me down a corridor. I wasn't expecting Andrew McCormick to be there. They had asked Andrew McCormick to be there. And what the DUP were saying to me was, listen to what Andrew McCormick is telling you, this confirms that some of our statements are correct. So they were putting a lot on Andrew McCormick's integrity and authority. Now, I can tell you that Mr. McCormick looked shaken that night. He did not look comfortable. That's for others to determine. Maybe he was just nervous about the situation. But the reason, Sam, I'm providing that context of behind the scenes of what happened that night was because it is Andrew McCormick who is saying that the dysfunctional relationship between the DUP minister, Jonathan Bell, and his advisor may have contributed to delays in dealing with the RHI crisis.
That's right. And actually, in his very lengthy evidence, Dr. McCormick talks about that meeting with you. He says there's actually one quite significant aspect of that where he says that the DUP had put some documents in front of him and had asked him to confirm their accuracy. That was obviously a very significant factor at that point where people were trying to work out who to trust. But he says that his understanding was that you were told that really he had attested to the accuracy of every document, and actually he hadn't attested to the accuracy of every document. Like, he does not allege that the DUP deliberately sought to mislead in that instance. He says maybe there was some misunderstanding, but it's clear from that incident that they thought he was very important in terms of establishing the credibility of who to believe here. And it's also clear from what he says that he felt at a later point that he was really being used by the DUP, where it suited them to say, listen to what Dr. McCormick says, he's somebody you can trust. And then when he later came out and said, actually, his understanding was that it was Arlene Foster's special advisor, Andrew Crawford, who had tried to delay cost controls, Mrs. Foster was really quite dismissive of that. So it's clear that he is a central figure in this, and a lot of his evidence, because it is not with the strings that are attached, I suppose, to some of the political figures where there is clearly infighting within the DUP, it will have a degree of weight, but it will obviously be for the inquiry to decide exactly who's accurate about these various incidents.
And Sam, just on that point, because I do think it's important, on the point where Andrew McCormick was in that corridor that night before the... actually, I'm not sure if it was before or after the Arlene Foster interview. I need to recollect that. But the night that Andrew McCormick was there, it is my understanding that he was not able to speak freely. He was only able to confirm the questions, the specific questions that he had been asked to tell me. So this was not a man that was able to stand there and say, look, here's everything I know. He was only able to address to me the specific questions that had been chosen for him to address to me. And I think that that's an interesting question around it. Sam, what happens this week? We've got Andrew McCormick today. What then happens?
We will then be into Jonathan Bell for the last 2 days of this week. Then next week we're into Timothy Kearns, his former special advisor. Then we're back to Andrew Crawford, and Andrew Crawford is really one of the central figures in this inquiry, if not the central figure thus far, and someone who was perhaps more involved in the RHI scheme than anybody knew at the time, and perhaps more involved than any other political figure from what we have heard so far in evidence. And I think over the next few weeks, we're going to have an incredible focus on what goes on within the DUP, on how Stormont was run, and how the top civil servants interacted with the DUP. And on one level, that is very interesting, and that is what we will be writing about. But I think there will be a lot of focus from the inquiry on trying to get into how that relates to its remit. So did any of this dysfunctionality, did any of these problems have a direct implication for the RHI scheme? Did this contribute in any way to the delays, to the dysfunctionality which we know existed with the scheme, or was it something that was actually separate and there were almost two tracks running here and neither of them really crossed over?
So just two further questions, Sam. Often the public will wonder about an inquiry as to whether... I've often, when we've covered different inquiries... heard the public saying, will we ever get the answers? Will we ever get to the truth? Whatever the truth is in this story, and that's for the RHI inquiry to determine. My goodness, I've heard a lot of people talk about the thoroughness of that inquiry and the detailed forensic examination that Sir Patrick Coughlan and his team are going into.
That's right. And I think what we see here, I mean, it's almost a cliche now in politics that if there's a big incident, if there's a scandal, that we have politicians coming out and calling for a full public inquiry. It's the gold standard of investigation into problems in government or elsewhere. I think what we see here in terms of the scale of a project like this, the expense of it, the number of people that are needed for this, is that it's not something that you do lightly. It is so thorough, it is so forensic, it is so expensive that it really is only for the most serious incidents. And I think it's pretty clear from what has come out of the RHI inquiry that this is something which touches on almost every aspect of how Stormont operated at a point where there is debate as to how Stormont should come back, whether Stormont should come back. I think it's absolutely going to be critical to that discussion what has come out of this inquiry. That is acknowledged by the civil service. It's acknowledged by some people privately in the DUP. And I think that is something which really puts this in quite a unique position. And I think that what we have seen here is that, as you said there, when you spoke to Andrew McCormick, when other people spoke to civil servants, even when they appeared before Stormont committees, they were still operating under the direction and control of a DUP minister. And that's a very difficult position for a senior civil servant to be in. There's no suggestion that they were doing anything other than telling the truth, but they were in a very awkward position. Where they find themselves now is a much more straightforward position, where they're compelled to tell everything that they know by the inquiry. And of course, without any Stormont in place, there is no way whatsoever, or there should be no way whatsoever, at which they feel constrained by any party, if indeed that was ever going to be a factor here.
And finally, Sam, when does this wrap up, the whole inquiry? What's the timeline? When does it reach its conclusion? And what are the political implications, possibly, of that conclusion?
Well, there's no simple answer to that, in that when Martin O'Meara set this up, he didn't give it a time limit, he didn't give it a budget, and he really said to the judge, he really turned it over to the judge and said, you investigate this thoroughly. He said that the judge had to be cognizant of the costs of it, but there is no statutory limit of any sort. So if some new evidence turns up, if some new witness needs to be called, it will presumably just keep going until it gets to a natural conclusion.
And just so that the public know, and sorry to interrupt, I do think this is important. You said about Martin O'Mueller setting this up. It is a statement of fact that at the beginning, Sinn Féin did not want an inquiry. They resisted an inquiry, and it was only subsequently then, after a process of resisting an inquiry, that they then set one up.
That's right. So if Sinn Féin had got what it wanted in the early weeks of January and certainly in late December, there would have been some sort of internal investigation. It would have been led by an independent figure from outside the civil service, perhaps a retired judge from outside the jurisdiction or something of that nature. But it would not have held its hearings in public. It would not have had the power to compel witnesses or documents. I mean, we see, for instance, in the massive documentation that was published last night, text messages, emails, all sorts of contact that simply would not have been able to have been compelled without the powers of a public inquiry. But once that was set up, Martin O'Meara set it up in a really pretty sweeping way, where he gave complete control to the judge. I think it's clear from the last few weeks of the hearings before it broke for the summer that the inquiry is trying now to move at a brisker pace. They are going to sit now every week rather than sitting for 2 weeks in every three. And I think there are some people who think that it may be wrapped up by the end of this year in terms of the oral hearings. Not entirely clear how long it would then take for the report to be written. But I think that once that is concluded, to a certain extent, it clears the air in a political sense. I don't think at this point that the RHI inquiry is the key impediment to Stormont coming back. I think it's clear that the DUP and Sinn Féin are really struggling on the Irish language issue and some other issues that they're trying to resolve. But it is a big unknown, particularly for the DUP and Sinn Féin. And from Sinn Féin's point of view, if they go back in a month's time and something really explosive comes out of the RHI inquiry 2 weeks later, it makes things very uncomfortable for them. Once that's out of the way, I think it's more straightforward. It's also there is also the possibility that, dependent on various factors, including what is in the final report from the inquiry, there may be a change of DUP leadership, and that would, of course, resolve to a certain extent one of the issues between the two parties. Sinn Féin has, of course, dropped its red line about Arlene Foster standing aside, but nevertheless, if she wasn't there, I think that would, to a certain extent, simplify things and remove at least one of the nominal impediments to them going back into Stormont.
Why do you say there may be a change in DUP leadership?
Well, I think that over the last year and a half or so, it's been clear that Arlene Foster's position has massively weakened. It was to a certain extent emboldened by the really resounding Westminster victory and the situation which flowed out of that. But I think that if you look at that campaign, it was a campaign which was led by Nigel Dodds. It was a campaign where the DUP were very eager to keep Arlene Foster away from the likes of you or me or any other journalist. And really, the sense that one has of the DUP as a party where the leader is very weak at this point, where if there was anyone credible that was coming forward to challenge her, she would be in deep difficulty. And really, the thing which is saving her her in a similar way to Theresa May, is that nobody is yet coming forward and putting their head above the parapet. I think that there is a natural point where an inquiry reports, if indeed it is critical of Arlene Foster, and it's entirely something which we can't say at this point, but if there is criticism of her, or if there is implied criticism of her, in that there's criticism of her special advisor for whom she was responsible as the minister, I think that is certainly something which, if you were one of her critics within the DUP, it would give you a natural point at which to come forward and challenge her.
Okay, Sam McBride, thank you very much indeed. That's a detailed analysis there from the newsletter's Sam McBride. Here's what I would encourage you to do. Go on to the RHI website. This is an incredibly thorough inquiry, as I've said. The level of forensic detail that Sir Patrick and his team is going into. And look, don't be thinking that this is something that doesn't affect you. This is one of these rare occasions where you are getting to see the functions of government, what your politicians did and didn't do when they never thought that this would all, who could have thought, nobody thought, that the whole behind the scenes mechanisms of what happened in government would be analysed in this type of forensic detail. So go onto the RHI website. The address is rhiinquiry.org, or follow our colleagues in the BBC newsroom, BBC News NI, where there is thorough analysis there as well.